You with James Latimer.
James Latimer, professor of percussion.
Okay.
UW-Madison.
All right, thank you. Mr. Latimer, first I would like to start off with some general questions about your childhood and young adult life, particularly as it pertained to your musical education. And I know some of these things that you and I have already discussed, but they haven't exactly been documented. But how old were you when you first started studying music and began to play percussion in particular?
I showed an interest in music around age 4 or 5. And I would say that it was, around age 7 or 8 when I started trying to play an instrument, which was a marimba, by the way. My father bought a marimba for my older sister. And I used to stand on a Coca-Cola box and try to play it. So that's my earliest recollection of music. And then from there, mother was a music teacher, and so she saw to it that I had music instruction.
Mm-hmm. So was there, with your sister and perhaps other siblings, always music was something that was expected of you or certainly encouraged by?
Yes, I would say music was required of us.
Okay.
Mother was a music teacher. And she saw to it that we learned the basics of music.
Okay.
And that we all had to play the piano.
Mm-hmm.
So she taught us.
Okay. Well, what about this music school, the Latimer School, that your mother founded and started? Could you tell us something about that and what your involvement in it was?
Well, exactly when it was founded, I don't know, but it had to be 50 years ago. And sometime around the middle of that, I guess around 1956, I guess it was, I joined Mother in managing the school for a year before I went to Florida A&M.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, she had her own separate building and an auditorium, and I don't know, she must have employed about 6 or 7 teachers.
Really?
Yeah.
Right off?
Yeah. Oh no, this was a privately run school,
mm-hmm.
huh? And then they were paid on a per pupil basis. But no, there were several people teaching at the time.
Wow. About how many students did she start off with?
Oh, I don't know how many she started off with, but it was, you know, in excess of 100 at the time that I was there.
Wow.
Quite a few.
That's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently in the area, then was the opportunity kind of restricted as to musical instruction? I mean, was it difficult to find teachers?
No. She just had a good reputation.
Good. Yeah.
She had a good reputation.
Yeah.
And so and there were voice students, instrumentalists, and I gather she was particularly pleased to have me because I had just received my degree from Indiana University in percussion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I added that to the dimension.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, to the mix. So it's still going, but on a much scaled down basis now. My sister, Rita, manages it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, she has not been in the best of health recently, so she may be getting ready to close it down. I'm not sure. No. But anyway, that's a brief history of it.
Okay. Well, who would you say besides, members of your immediate family were your early musical influences, and then later on, who some of your professional or other influences were?
Well, I hesitate to answer that question because I really don't know. I mean, I was influenced by so many people. On the one hand, my dad ran a restaurant, a barbecue, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And at that time, we had the latest recordings, jazz, pop music recordings, country, western recordings. I heard music from so many different angles. And on top of that, even though Tulsa at the time was somewhat segregated, Mother insisted that we be taken to symphony. So I heard the Tulsa Philharmonic, I heard the Dallas Philharmonic, and I heard choirs, I heard Marian Anderson, I heard, oh, so many people as I was growing up. So to sort them out, I knew who was out there on a limited range basis. Now, I didn't know who was at the Metropolitan Opera. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know about that, okay? But I did know there was a symphony orchestra in town. And of course, now let's see. There was a musical group. There were lots of musical groups in Tulsa, but one in particular was the North Tulsa Male Chorus, conducted by Opaline Bradley. A really outstanding musical group of all men, and they would give a concert once or twice a year. But she was a very fine, classically trained choral person, and kept this, again, I think that group may be still going. Really? In Tulsa, yeah.
Wow.
So I heard lots of music, and then I heard the music of the church, and of course Mother was involved in music in church, and we had lots of performances there. We also had a family orchestra.
Really? Oh, the Latimer family orchestra, was it?
Yeah, because my oldest sister played accordion, cello, piano very well, because she had an independent career in music of her own. And let's see, my oldest brother played trumpet in addition to piano, and then my next brother played clarinet and oboe. And then I guess I played piano and marimba at the time. I don't remember what I was doing in there, but I was in there somehow. And then my sister played piano, and seems like to me she played violin too. I'm not sure about that. But, and let's see, then my younger brother, I don't think he was participating at the time, but he later played oboe.
Okay, wow, I guess you did sort of have like a built-in
orchestra. Yeah, so we would use, you know, strange arrangements to play things. I remember one piece we played, the Song of India. That's all I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow. Well, would you say then that this sort of too began your interest in music composition? I mean, were you at this stage even?
Yeah, I was curious about writing of music. I didn't write as much at that stage as I did later on. Mm-hmm. But that's where it started.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you talked about all of these various influences that you had, but would you say that your background has primarily been classical? Would you say that there's a balance between classical and
I think it was primarily 90% classical as I was growing up. However, you have to remember that I worked in an environment in which Duke was playing, Louis Jordan, Lionel Hampton. So I took note of that music, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, there was not much jazz playing at home, okay? A few popular tunes, but not much.
Okay.
Mother was a classicist.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, I've noted, you know, in your vita that you did a stint with Max Roach. What was it like studying with him?
Well, it really wasn't a study so much as it was a consultation. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from Max, because Max came here and actually taught in this room. Okay? He's been here twice. And so we made lots of videotapes of it, which are not in the best of shape now because the tape wasn't good. But I sat in on, many, many hours of his teaching and that kind of thing. As a matter of fact, the fact that we teach improvisation at the University of Wisconsin now in percussion is due directly to Max Roach.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So is that what you would say you sort of...
That I gained from him? Yeah. Oh, yeah. And a fluidness of thought. You know, he is one of the best minds in the music business. Now, he plays drums, but he plays drums in a classic fashion. I mean, he's like Mozart.
Wow.
Yeah. Very, very logical thinking. You know, I can always tell, you know, even on a recording that of his that I haven't heard where he plays, I can say, okay, that has to be Max, because the structuring of the ideas. And so he that way he was a definite influence on me.
Wow.
Very profound. And we hope to have him back again if we can do it. He was just here
last April, I believe.
Yeah,
wasn't
I think it was.
Yeah, I saw the concert.
Yeah, that's
I think
right.
It was April.
Yeah, last year.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I keep in touch with Max.
Good.
And Alan Dawson as well. Alan out of Boston. Hopefully he'll be here next year.
Okay.
Yeah. But these guys are fantastic thinkers. Now they happen to be percussionists, but they think globally. They think universally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, would you see yourself sort of as in this role of an innovator in some way in percussion? I mean, I know that these men definitely have been noted as some of the greatest ones.
Yeah, I've participated in percussion's 20th century expansion. You've got to remember that this whole thing started off in the mid-40s down in Chicago with Roy Knapp, and was picked up by Paul Price and company and pushed a little further down at the University of Illinois, Urbana. And at that time, I was at Indiana studying under Richard Johnson. But we went over to Urbana to see what they were doing, because Richard started a percussion ensemble at Indiana in the early 50s. And I participated in that. So, see, that's almost 40 years of percussion ensemble expansion.
Okay.
That I've had the privilege to be involved with.
Okay. And I know, too, that you've, you know, started several groups, you know, been the founder of several, you know, of your own percussion groups, you know, in various areas on the East Coast and in perhaps here in Madison.
And Florida.
In Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah,
right,
I've been
exactly.
In Oklahoma.
It's been you.
Yeah.
Wow. Could you, well, the current group, this is actually the first I've heard of, Jim Latimer and Friends.
Okay, now that's not a percussion
that
group. That's not a percussion
that's
group.
Well,
that's just what do you call it? It's the combo.
Mm-hmm.
It's combo, and it's a community-based combo. All
mm-hmm.
right.
Okay.
But now what I have done here, that aside from the University of Wisconsin Percussion Ensemble, which has its own marks, I mean, it is recorded, it has done everything, the latest adventure is the Madison Marimba Quartet, in which we are playing the string quartets of Beethoven, Mozart, Dvorak, Brahms on four marimbas. And we use the original manuscripts. We read alto clef, tenor clef, etc. And it's a fantastic group.
Wow.
I think it has great potential. I want to see how far it can go.
And how old is this group?
Well, the idea has been developing over the past 6 or 8 years. It has, I say that it has formally taken off and is moving for the last 2 years. Well, I had to have a $10,000 instrument built in order to accommodate
okay.
the range. But after we hawked our souls and got that, I would say that's when it formally took off.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and there it is, sitting right over there.
That's
a 5-octave marimba, right?
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, what do you see, or how do you see the role of percussion development at the university? I mean, when you came, you know, what stage was percussion in, and you know, what I know that you've done a lot, but maybe you could give us some specifics.
Well, it's been a bittersweet relationship. I'd say it's been sweet because the people to whom I've had to report to have been generous. They have seen my point of view in many, many instances. On the other hand, I've been criticized as being somewhat of a spoiled brat, because I insist that we have certain things and that we keep it in operable condition. For example, you have to have practice room setups in which a set of timpani sits there until a person comes and plays them. It's like an organ. You cannot, you know, each student can't buy his or her own organ. You know, we have a separate recital hall here for organ, okay? And so you see the size of this studio. Well, you know, people have said he's empire building, but this is absolutely necessary. And this is minimal. This is not extravagant. We need twice this size of space because of instruments and ideas that have developed in the last, say, 10 years only.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, you look at this and you say, wow, you should be happy. But this is not the end. This is only the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And so from that standpoint of view, it's been a little bit, I've suffered as other people have suffered in the university setting. University, on the one hand, is at the forefront of knowledge exploration. But on the other hand, it drags its feet in terms of implementing what the rest of the world takes for granted, you know, and goes on with, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, for example, I remember how many years ago it was only recently that students here could enroll via computers, via the telephone. They used to walk around 40,000
right.
buildings and collect signatures.
Right.
And John Bardeen, the inventor of not the integrated circuit, but the, what's the name of the thing? So the electronic device that replaced the tube, the vacuum tube. Oh, a transistor. Okay. John Bardeen went to school here, okay? And another little young lady is going to make her mark in the world in electronics is Deanna Schmidt, who plays in the percussion ensemble
really?
Here. She's been hired by Bell Laboratories to work in their laboratories this summer. See? And Apple picked up one of the UW percussionists. Now, they happen to be dual majors, or they were electronic majors,
mm-hmm.
they played percussion. But nevertheless, I get credit for it.
Well, and that's perfectly all right. It's perfectly
all
right.
So the point I started out to say was that, in a university setting, even though it's at the forefront, sometimes it's peculiar how it handles itself. The front end doesn't know what the back end is doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So on the one hand, they were brilliant in bringing me here in 1968, but then they did certain things and they said, okay, now that's enough now, but you have to compete, you got to keep up to date.
Sure.
Yeah,
well, let me ask this, do you believe that your minority status makes you hesitate in requesting certain things? Do you feel that being rejected about the purchase of certain equipment or the expansion of your studio has anything to do with your minority standing?
No, I don't think that. I think that they just feel that they have done enough, and it's going to take a new generation of blood and energy,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I'm reaching the point now where I'm starting to feel aches and pains in this whole body, you see. And so that coupled with, you know, I guess there's an X amount of burnout that one suffers after being on the job, combines rather than the racial thing. I think, you know, that I can go and ask. But everybody's being told no right now, you see.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that. I think once they opened the doors here and gave me the keys. By the way, I have an interesting story to tell you about the key.
Okay. Okay.
Bless his heart, he's dead now. Dale Gilbert, who was chairman, who hired me, for some strange reason, after I arrived here, and it was several years after I arrived here, decided that no faculty member should have keys to this building. Now, mind you, Roxanne, I have thousands of dollars of personal equipment in my office around here, and I could not get at that equipment except that I had to go and call security. This went on for 12 years. Finally, one day, I walked into the then chairman's office. This was long after Dale was dead, and I just was fuming, and I said, and I tell you why I was fuming, because I had learned in the meantime that certain faculty members had been given their keys back,
mm-hmm.
but mine was not returned,
mm-hmm.
okay? So I was really steaming after
mm-hmm.
that, and I do have my keys now,
okay?
I can come in here any time of day and night and do what I wish to do, but that went on for 12 years.
Wow.
So I think that's a story that should be on your TV.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. Most definitely. Well, I would certainly hope
that. And every time I open that door, the thing that goes through my mind is the Apple statement, the power to be your best.
Uh-huh.
All right? It means whatever, whenever I feel like I need to experiment, practice, research, type, compute, I don't care what it is. I just take the key and open the door and go do it.
And you should have that privilege. I can imagine it for 12
because
years.
Because ideas come at all times of day and night, you know?
Sure.
And furthermore, sometimes I've been out, you know, playing jobs. You mentioned about Jim Latimer and friends, you know. We play weddings, anniversaries, you name it. Well, sometimes equipment is in this building that I have to have. And, you know, I've been standing out at doors 20 below zero waiting for security to come open this building. And I've just about wanted to, quote, kill somebody, end quote.
Okay.
You
know? Wow.
Yeah. Sorry.
So, well, no, that's quite all right. I just kind of let that rest. I'd like to sort of pursue that a little more. But certainly it sort of puts us at the point of sort of the bulk of what I wanted to get at. And that was your hiring in 1968, certainly in the thick of student uprisings, and for my purposes here, in particular, the black student uprisings. And I know that as a result of the student protests, there were a list of demands that black students conceived and requested they be met.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you were a part of a committee on some of these activities to meet these demands. Could you just
that
tell
occurred,
us a little bit about your
Yes, that meeting? Occurred shortly after I arrived here. As a matter of fact, as I was arriving, I auditioned here in the winter, right in the spring of 68. I came to work here in the fall of 68. The previous, if my memory serves me correct, the previous uprising in the University of Wisconsin-Madison has had many student uprisings, not just those 13 students, but I think it was the Dow Chemical people.
Mm-hmm.
Their presence on campus was the spark for that. So that was dovetailed immediately with the black student, the 13 demands they were called. And that I walked right into as I was unpacking my things on campus. They were getting their show together, okay? Frida High was a student then. Paul Seidlinger, I guess, was a student then, too. The now present mayor. Well, anyhow, my former wife was somewhat injured out here at the intersection in the tear gas canister fell. I guess it, you know, whatever it does, it almost chokes you to death or whatever it was, but she got out of it. But no, we were right here when the National Guard was patrolling all of this campus.
Well, how did that make you feel? I mean, did you feel compelled to decide, you know, the students, what was asked of you?
Well, now, it didn't strike me as strange, and I'll tell you why. That was the time just after Martin Luther King was assassinated, if I remember correctly, 1968, April 4th.
That's right.
I was in Los Angeles, California, with Sarah Caldwell and the American National Opera Company. As a matter of fact, Zubin Mehta, who went on to conduct the New York Philharmonic, was then conducting the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and Bill Kraft was the timpanist. Now, the reason why I mention these folks is that I have personal, you know, warm regards for them. Kraft has been here at least 3 or 4 times, William Kraft.
Mm-hmm.
And Zubin talked to me at the time he came to the performance. We were doing Stravinsky's Rake's Progress, I think it was. Either that or it was Puccini or something. But anyway, he came backstage and spoke to us. And I just thought that was so fantastic. And you know what? I went to, I think it's Lincoln Center, where the New York Philharmonic rehearses. I went there to see some percussionists many years after that. And Zubin was conducting. And he remembered.
Really?
Yeah, he remembered.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I just happen to think he's a fabulous person anyway. But anyhow, you were asking me about the student demands and the climate and how it affected us and
yes.
so forth. Well, it didn't strike me as strange. We knew that something was going to happen anyway, because your big cities, you know, were suffering from riots then, you know, partly in sympathy to Dr. King's death and mm-hmm. so forth. But before that, you had all these marches in the South. See, and I was in the South in 19... Well, to make a long story short, we knew something like that was coming, but we didn't know that it was coming here, because I actually was living in Boston prior to coming here, and I said, well, you know, the cities are going to erupt. Maybe we ought to get out where there's a little more air and there's a little less of this, you know, people living on top of each other and so forth, like you have in New York and in Boston. And I walked in here, and lo and behold, it was war zone number one.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, indeed. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah, because I never saw tear gas in Boston or New York, but I saw it and felt it here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, would you have felt that your job was in jeopardy if you had taken a more active role? I mean, I know that you were asked to be on the committee for the formation of the Afro-American Studies Department and some of those things. Could you tell a little bit about that?
Right. Well, I spent many, many years on that committee. At times, things got pretty heated up. As a matter of fact, I think it was... No, it wasn't Dave Cronin. It was... I can't remember his name now. But he's retired now, professor. Oh, very good guy. And he, at one point, we were in a meeting in, I think it was in Mills Hall, and he said, Jim, you better get out. It's going to get a little rough. And they pulled us out of there at that point.
Out of the meeting,
yeah.
You mean?
Wilson. Wilson Thede. Professor Wilson Thede was his name. And a former dean and so forth, you know, but I think he was a dean. At least he was very, very knowledgeable person. He was on the university committee and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, but at that point, I recognized, hey, this could be a dangerous situation. And let's see, there was one other time when the university police came and got us out of a confrontation. We were up in some building. It could have been up here in 2650.
Mm-hmm.
And we were surrounded by students, and the officers came up and said, if it could get pretty ugly, you better get out. And they gave us safe passage out of there at that time.
Yeah.
So there were a couple of times. So other times it was just heated arguments and words being tossed back and forth, you know, but it was something.
Yeah, but something came out of it. I mean,
oh yeah, we hammered out the Afro-American Studies Department, which I think is one of the best in the country. I mean, it's set solidly in L&S, so that it isn't visible when the budget goes down to the Senate or down to the state capitol, so that people who have particular prejudices against that kind of operation can't reach in and lop it off.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a major consideration at mm-hmm. the time. The students thought we were wrong in doing that. They wanted independence, they wanted an independent college, they wanted their own dean, their own monies. Well, that's a very visible profile. Even the School of Music today is debating whether they want to do that or not. Because if you're an independent school, a dean, with your own dean, mm-hmm. you report directly to the chancellor, and the chancellor directly downstairs, and they can examine your budgets, and they can make direct cuts on you.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it is now, it's set in there along with Asian studies, Indian studies, women's studies, etc. Okay?
Right.
And it's well safe. I mean, it'll be there.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, how do you see the relationship, you know, Afro-American studies and the music department, particularly at this time? I mean, how did the music department benefit and, you know,
well,
sort of changes?
Well, we've benefited like we have all benefited, and I'll give you a parallel example. The handicapped people have said for years, we can't operate wheelchairs upstairs, stairways, or down curbs. You have to do, you know. Well, most of us well people said, no, at first we didn't think about it. But now we're glad, because at times, you know, when your bones ache, you can walk up an inclined plane, or if your hands are full, you can touch a button and the door opens, you know. So I'm saying that I think scholars, departments here at the university have benefited from the presence of the Afro-American scholars. Not only that, but the whole country has benefited, because these people have now had time to sit and look at the facts and put the material in its proper perspective, so that now you see textbooks being written that include the activities of all Americans. Whereas in before that time, those textbooks did not include that. Mm-hmm. When I went to high school, we studied out of a separate text on Afro-American achievements. Mm-hmm. Now, I was lucky, because our high school had individuals who were skilled in, I don't know where they collected all their knowledge, but I have the textbooks. They were so interesting. At first, I didn't believe it, because you say, well, why aren't they in the social studies book?
Right.
Okay, but then as you grow and mature, you recognize at the time that the system excluded them. My wife, former wife rather, worked for Ginn and Company, textbook publishers in Boston. And their early textbooks they weren't even concerned about the progress of Afro-Americans. So you see, this whole country has benefited from the presence of these Afro-American scholars. Now they have time to study the case of X, Y, and Z and say, no, this is not the way it was. This is the way it was. You know that town in Florida, that Rosewood, was it called? That disappeared, that the entire town was destroyed? It's news now. Because they're going to compensate some of those individuals that are surviving that, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those kinds of things could go on and be hidden.
Mm-hmm.
But now, those facts are being brought out now, and legislators are being fed the correct information, you see, and they're going to issue a stamp to the Buffalo Soldiers, who were issued the worst uniforms, the worst rifles, the worst X, Y, and Z, and yet they did the finest job, so much so that the enemy praised them. The then enemy, you know, the enemy is always relative.
Right. Well, specifically though, and more directly, how do you see the relationship between, you know, changes that were made, you know, with the institution of the Afro-American Studies Department, and changes that you saw as parallel with the School of Music? Was there an increase, in fact, in black student enrollment, or minority student enrollment in general?
Well, you know, to answer that question, I'm not knowledgeable on the subject, okay? But from my casual observation, there was an upsurge for a while, okay? As long as there was a concerted effort. But then I think it has tapered off. I think we actually have as few minority, if not one less, than when I arrived here. So there has not been a permanent upswing in terms of minority participation at the UW School of Music.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about classes? What about courses that are being offered?
Yes, that is very powerful, and that has made a difference. And I think perhaps given a few more years and a few more efforts, we're going to attract some minorities. They will come.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a lag time there. For example, Richard Davis's course has done an awful lot for the furtherance of jazz and for the explanation of how many Afro-Americans have participated in music outside of the classical setting. I think, though I cannot verify this, you perhaps know better than I do, that some of the music history courses now might acknowledge that there is an aspect of American music popularly called jazz that has made a worldwide contribution. Mm-hmm. I've looked at a few textbooks. The textbooks that I have don't mention Duke Ellington.
Really?
Mm-hmm. No. And I'm talking about 20th century mm-hmm. music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Norton publication series,
right.
You know, that's the one. Now, my good friend, what's her name? You know, the preeminent female black musicologist.
Eileen Southern.
Yes,
yeah.
Eileen Southern wrote the series for Norton.
Yeah.
But see, that was written as a separate thing,
sure.
First of all. Now that's a source that's being integrated in other things. And that's directly what that's what the Afro-American Studies Department has done here,
mm-hmm.
region-wise and nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
These people have had enough time, you know, Samuel Floyd down here in Chicago,
right.
has had enough time to sit and enough money, because creative research and writing is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sit on your behind and do all this research. You gotta have money to eat and pay bills.
Sure.
You see, and so,
sure.
You know, grants and that kind of stuff made this possible now, and that's why that department is so valuable.
Okay.
So it has helped everybody.
Well, do you see, I mean, I know, of course, there's always room for expansion and growth,
mm-hmm.
But how firmly do you believe that black music courses, let's say a course in jazz history,
mm-hmm.
Has come under the umbrella of any other history course in music that's being offered?
Well,
but I mean, we have yet to make the bridge between.
Yeah.
You know, the
I think, well, I think it's going to take its place alongside a course in African music or Jewish music or specialized courses such as, and every now and then you'll see a course on Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think these individuals, and this is being borne out, and you don't have to take my word for it,
mm-hmm.
these individuals have done enough in their lifetime that books and courses will continue to be written about them. By the way, did you know that we had Duke Ellington here for 1 week?
Yes,
as an in-residence scholar?
Yes.
He actually conducted classes in Mills Hall. The entire band was here.
And
you know, a tragedy is that part of that film that was made during that week has been lost and or stolen. And if I might say on this tape for future generations and scholars, if those tapes ever appear anywhere in the world, they should be confiscated and the university should persecute whoever has them.
Wow.
Because it was a deliberate attempt. It was taken from the vaults out of WHA. Okay?
Really?
I wrote the chancellor about it, and it's something I want future people to know, that there were several $1,000 worth of film footage on Duke Ellington that has disappeared from the archives here.
And how soon after the tapes were made?
Well, it was a long time, but and I accept partial blame for that. I just trusted that they would be there and that I was trying to raise the money. I was trying to raise $65,000. But anyway, I don't think it's permanently lost. I think they're waiting for some of us to die and then they'll move it. But
wow.
So note that. Okay.
So that it was a very suspicious circumstance.
Yeah,
which
very,
is
very shady. Very shady.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, would you say, if I might be so bold as to ask, that your experience here as a minority faculty has, for the most part, been what you expected, been positive, been negative?
Yeah, no, I think it's been a positive and a very enriching experience. And I'm talking specifically about historical as well as contemporary percussion research and performance. That has been carried on. We have students who are now teaching in colleges and universities and playing in such groups as the Coast Guard Band. And there was one student, he's dead now, I'm sorry to say, but he was first percussionist with the Frankfurt Opera Company, Frankfurt, Germany. So they have been placed in high places, and they've come from Wisconsin roots and so when you think of that, you tend to say, well, it was worth it all.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, any insults that were thrown my way were simply transformed into some usable energy. There were some. You know.
Sure.
I mean, there was a cross burned on our lawn twice.
No, really?
Yeah. But it fades as time goes by. Okay?
So at any point did you feel that you might leave? You didn't at any point feel that you might leave because
well,
of the things that were happening?
I contemplated leaving. I did leave.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I was gone for 3 years, which was rather rare.
Mm-hmm.
And it was timely.
Mm-hmm.
I needed it. Things exploded internally and somewhat externally. I had been doing too much. I had been spreading myself awfully thin. I was conducting the Youth Symphony, and things were not happening well at home, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that was around 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, well, it's best for me to bow out of this. And so I resigned from the Youth Symphony,
mm-hmm.
and I received a sabbatical. And it was just a convenient time for me to let go of some of those reins. And then when I came back, I concentrated on percussion, basically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do I want to go from here? How would you say... that socially, then, well, let's say outside of the School of Music, because
mm-hmm.
you're still a member of the Madison Symphony Orchestra and have been since
mm-hmm.
you arrived here in 1968. What has your experience there been, professionally and socially? I mean, it's such a close connection with the UW School of Music.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe that experience as?
I would describe it as polite.
Mm.
Okay. But for the most part, I have existed pretty much in a vacuum.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't know how to explain this. It isn't that I wanted unusual secrets and tips or inside trading information, to use another field parallel, but one could just use just friendly conversation, chit chat, if you will, or an occasional thank you and pat on the back, real camaraderie, if you will. I sense that a great deal of that has been lacking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it isn't anybody's fault. It's at the institution, because we have all been trained and raised in the way that we should go, okay? And so that if your mother has told you, for example, that playing chords is sinful, and every time you were caught doing that, it was reinforced that it was no good, or that going to a movie on Sunday is immoral.
Mm-hmm.
You better believe that when you reach adult age, if you've been under careful supervision, you're not going to break away from that. That's the way you were trained, okay? And so many of my colleagues were raised in separate and unequal environments, and they just not, we, I'll say, put it that way, myself included, we have not been able to bridge that gap,
yeah.
You know, I mean, to just reach out. Now, I noticed with some of the younger people, they do it automatically. They don't hesitate. They just brush right up against you,
mm-hmm.
if necessary, okay? But my age and a little older, to answer your question, it has been pretty much a lonely thing.
Mm-hmm.
Richard has remarked to me on more than one occasion, I'm glad you're here because it's just so nice to talk to somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and not about anything controversial, just chit-chat.
Just to talk.
You know, he just
sure.
comes over to the house and we watch movies and eat dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Or we'd go out to dinner occasionally. It was just, you know. Some, for whatever the reason, those things have been missing amongst the others. Yeah. Well, not all of them, but mostly.
Yeah. Well, aside from interim minority faculty persons, like, well, Cecil Taylor was here for like a year.
Yes.
Have you and Richard Davis been the only African-American faculty who've been here for any length of time?
I think so. Now, there's Elizabeth Gutierrez, who is a Spanish instructor.
Right.
And Javier.
Mm-hmm.
But they've just come within the past 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think Richard and I stood out there in many a winter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, could you speak just a little bit? I know that you were at Florida A&M for a brief period.
Mm-hmm. 5 years.
5 years. Would you have stayed longer if the opportunity had presented itself? And
yeah, I was set to go back to Florida A&M. Degree from Boston University. I called, I think we called him Pat Foster. It was Bill, William Foster, who was the head of the Department of Music. And I had a very simple request. I had formed this group called New Boston Percussion Ensemble. And by the way, Alan Dawson was one of the original members of that.
Mm-hmm.
I had maybe 10 or 12 engagements for the coming year. Not very many, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, for some reason, asked permission to keep those engagements. I said, I'm ready to come back to Florida A&M. Will it be all right for me to come out on such and such occasion to play these concerts? All right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. And it rather shocked me at the time. And for some reason, I decided, I'm not going back. Because to me, it was such a simple request. And if I couldn't do that, well, you know, that was my life. That's what I wanted to do.
So does it go without saying then, and dare I be so general as to ask that, do you believe you're given here at a predominantly white institution more artistic license than you would have been?
Definitely. Now, I don't know how Florida A&M is now,
mm-hmm.
but it had a rather narrow view at that time,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that could be explained, too, because they didn't have the worldwide contact that they have now,
mm-hmm.
okay? But then there was, you know, kind of tunnel vision, whereas this university has always encouraged you to go and do research and to perform. They want you to go out and play.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And you have.
Oh, yeah.
Cairo, Egyptian.
My first 7 years here, I think about every other week I was over in mm-hmm. Boston. As a matter of fact, they kind of criticized me a little bit for, you know, is he working here or is he working there? You know. So.
Okay.
But, no, it has had that. Now, that's the sweet part of it,
mm-hmm.
okay? That's the sweet part
of
it. No, they've been very nice to me, and they let you rearrange your classes and so forth.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, I'm correct that, you know, when we spoke earlier, your association with Marvin Rabin, this was a Boston connection?
That's correct. That's
okay.
correct. Yeah. He was the conductor of, he was on the faculty at Boston University,
mm-hmm.
and conductor and founder of the Greater Boston Youth Symphony. And before that, he conducted the Kentucky Youth Symphony. Why don't you stop that? Just pick right up there. How's
mm-hmm.
that? Yeah. But he was on the faculty and founded the Greater Boston Youth Symphony. And I was at Florida A&M when I first heard of him. And when I arrived at Boston University, you know, he found me down. I was given a graduate assistantship, and he found me and welcomed me and told me what he was doing and said we wanted to work together. But, you know, right from the beginning, he was just friendly, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And always has been. Still is, as a matter of fact. So I helped with the Greater Boston Youth Symphony for, I guess, a couple of years. And, followed the Marvin around on a couple of occasions around New England, you know. And that has continued, you know, right up to this time. He left Boston, I think, in 66 and came here. And then in 1968, I got this call or this letter from University of Wisconsin. And he had put my name in.
I see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Michael Dreeves was originally hired to be the percussion teacher here. Yeah. But he was killed in an automobile accident after he had arrived here. He was only here three or four months.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, I think Siwi, who's now down at the University of Illinois, Tom, finished out his year, I think, came up here and taught it because he was hauling some stuff to the dump with some gasoline, so I was told, and had an accident and exploded and all that kind of stuff.
I don't know. That's pretty terrible.
Tragic, yeah. Well, anyhow, Marvin spoke on my behalf, and so I came out here and auditioned, and they liked the way I played and the way I talked, I guess, and so I was extended an invitation to join the faculty here.
Okay.